Thank you for tuning into this episode of the MHP podcast. I have Dr. Brian Cohen from Victoria Urological here with us today, and I appreciate your time and joining us for this conversation.
I'm glad to be here.
So tell me a little bit about you and what brought you to do the work that you do now.
Okay, sure. I grew up in Chapel Hill and went there for college and medical school and took some time off in medical school and did a master's in public health and epidemiology as
nice.
Well.
I didn't know that.
And then I did my urology residency and fellowship in Miami, Florida at the University of Miami. And my fellowship was in, at that time, what was called female urology, urodynamics, neurourology. So we did a lot of pelvic floor reconstruction in females. We did a lot of urethral reconstruction in men. So a lot of neurogenic bladder patients with spinal cord injury. We had a big spinal cord unit at the VA that was across the street from Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. We did a lot of urodynamics tests. We did investigations in Botox before that was FDA approved. We do a lot of InterStim devices for managing refractory overactive bladder patients. So we did a lot of male and female voiding dysfunction. With men, a lot of obstruction and overactive symptoms with BPH. In my practice here in Asheville, I've been here for 8 years now with Victoria Urological Associates. And I've been continuing to do a lot of that. So we do Botox injections in the office, InterStim procedures. For men, you know, we're starting to do a procedure called UroLift, which is a new office procedure that's done for BPH. So, you know, still focusing mainly on voiding dysfunction and seeing a lot of both men and women who have pelvic floor issues and urethral issues and those kind of things.
It's a major quality of life issue. I know, I mean, for on the primary care side, we see these folks that, I mean, sometimes it affects how often they get out of the house or how far they travel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, anybody who's got incontinence, if you hop on a plane, you know, you got to pack an extra bag, pay $50 of, you know, just having incontinence pads, which themselves probably cost $50 to fill that suitcase. So, yeah, it's a major quality of life issue.
Yeah. I am interested a little bit in the public health bent and then going into a surgical subspecialty. It seems like a...
I mean, I think at this point in time... I think looking back on it, I think that the master's in public health and epidemiology was useful because I think it showed me that I did not want to do academic urology. I during that time, I led a study, a pilot study for a $10 million DOD grant that one of the epidemiologists and urologists were investigating, looking at dietary differences between African-American populations in North Carolina and Louisiana and how they have different incidence and prevalence of prostate cancer.
Interesting. So, yeah.
That's neat. It was a good experience. It was interesting to do. I think for me, there was just too much headaches and
the grant writing
process not something that was terribly interesting.
It's not for everyone for sure. But the idea that the role of how our environment and policy affects, you know, healthcare is a big deal no matter what specialty, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's important. You know, it's a good background to have in this day and age where you're looking at, you know, population-based statistics and, you know, the way that healthcare is going at this point in time, as well as looking at, you know, evidence-based medicine as well.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Well, I think our focus today, of all the list of topics we could talk about in urology and its interaction with our providers that are listening, and also we have a lot of consumers that are listening as well. We thought we'd narrow it down to just a couple common topics. And the goal here, just for the folks that are listening, is to kind of inform both the consumers and the primary care providers as much as anything to understand where some of the headaches are. And if there's one goal of this network is to increase conversations between specialists and primary care docs. And I know there are sometimes referrals that you might get for things that sometimes all the appropriate tests aren't done and you don't have all the information at your fingertips. So we had discussed concentrating on blood in the urine or hematuria and urinary tract infections. And starting with blood in the urine, I mean, obviously for us on the primary care side, it is often hard to know. I think nobody wants to miss the cancer, but in all likelihood it's not cancers, and trying to figure out the right path to kind of get to the right workup can be challenging. But I'm going to speak to that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, I think from our standpoint as specialists, you know, we want to make sure that our time is being used as efficiently as possible, but it also is for the patient too. You know, when they get sent to us and there's not an appropriate evaluation done, or we don't get the information that may have been done, you know, we're kind of wasting the patient's time too, and that feels bad as well.
Of course.
So we want to make sure that everyone's time is getting used as efficiently and best as possible.
Yeah.
And sometimes we see patients in the office that get sent for a hematuria evaluation, which indicates that there's blood that has been found in the urine, which really shouldn't be there. A screening test for this is doing the urine dipstick analysis, and I'm sure everybody probably has, you know, a ClinTech machine in their office where we do a dipstick. We have, you know, three or four of them in our office because we're doing urine samples on practically everybody that walks in the door. A dipstick analysis basically has chemical reagents on a piece of paper that you then dip into the urine, and it's, you know, changes in the color spectrum are analyzed by this machine. And, you know, you can get a lot of false positives and false negatives depending on vitamins the patient takes, medications such as, you know, over-the-counter AZO, which people can take for burning with the urination, pyridium, phenazopyridine, you know, those kind of things that can alter the color of the urine will alter this test. And you can get false positives, false negatives for a multitude of different reasons.
Sure.
What needs to be noted is that the dipstick analysis is a screening test. And a screening test does not mean that you have something. It means that you may have something and it needs to be confirmed by really what the gold standard is, which would be urine microscopy, which is a microscopic evaluation after centrifuging the urine and looking at the sediment underneath the microscope with your own eyes.
Physically seeing red blood cells.
Exactly. And the AUA guidelines state that, you know, on a well-conducted urinalysis, microscopy, at least 3 red blood cells per high-powered field should indicate a need for a urologic evaluation. Now, if, you know, you have a female who's menstruating, you know, almost every single time you see blood in the urine, and it's not a urologic source that is coming from, obviously. So if you do see that and the woman tells you that she's, you know, having her menstrual cycle at that time, it's something that needs to be repeated probably a week or two down the road once her cycle is over and confirm whether or not it truly is, you know, hematuria or not. You know, someone that comes in who's had a CAT scan, who's passing a kidney stone, you know, they went to the ER and now they're in your office and they've got blood in the urine. You know, when you have a defined cause of microscopic hematuria, or in that case, potentially gross hematuria as well, again, it's not something that needs to be further evaluated other than the information that you already have and already know about. So.
Right. And so speaking about that, those two scenarios, there's the scenario where someone comes in and they see blood in the urine, and that's the chief complaint. I see them in my primary care schedule. They see blood in the urine. We evaluate them. We do a urinalysis, and we see not only a positive blood on the dipstick, but also a positive microscopy. Let's assume in this scenario, you know, there isn't another obvious circumstance. No known stone. It's a female that's not menstruating. And obviously it depends on symptoms, but you know, if we were suspicious, let's say, of a kidney stone, which is often number one on our list for most people that come in with maybe pain and or blood in the urine, we think kidney stone until proven otherwise. Is that a fair initial?
I think it's a fair initial evaluation. You know, it brings up other issues that we see, you know, as far as how to evaluate for a kidney stone. And I think one of the things that's really lacking with that is a good physical examination and good history taking with that. One thing else I'd point out, Rob, is that, you know, for somebody that comes in and says, you know, I saw blood in the urine when I passed urine, you know, 2 days ago. Even if you check the urine at that point in time, and it happens frequently in our office as well, you look at the urine dipstick, it shows no blood. You look at it with microscopy as well, it shows no blood cells. Anytime somebody has gross hematuria, it's something that does need an evaluation, regardless of how the urine looks that day that they're in your office. So,
That's a really good point. And in all likelihood, then, if we have unexplained, that's a good scenario, unexplained gross blood in the urine, even if it's resolved, are you suggesting there should be a referral at that point just to further evaluate
it? Yes, and most of the time I'd say we're seeing probably painless hematuria is much more often than not somebody who comes in with flank pain and has it. So most of the time we're seeing somebody who, you know, is not having dysuria, is not having pain and burning, passing the urine. You know, and I ask people all the time, you know, if you closed your eyes and passed your urine, would you notice that there's any blood in there or anything is any different?
Yeah,
so
that's a good question.
I think it's a good way to ask people, you know, if they are truly symptomatic versus asymptomatic when blood in the urine is being evaluated.
And it oftentimes we sometimes discuss it in certain other cancers as well, where it's the conditions without pain. Certainly depends on location and lots of things, but that can be more ominous or more concerning. Is that generally true with either bladder cancers or other form of urinary tract cancers?
Yeah, I mean, really the only time that we find bladder cancers in this day and age is not because people are typically having symptoms. It's typically, you know, asymptomatic microscopic hematuria.
Yeah.
You know, the most common way that renal cell cancers are found in this day and age are they're incidentally found because right. someone has some vague abdominal or back pain and a CAT scan gets done and, you know, yep. for some completely unrelated reason typically. So, right. you know, anytime that you've got somebody who's got asymptomatic microscopic hematuria, you know, those scenarios need to be kept in the back of your mind and not just, you know, blow it off. Oh, maybe it's a urinary tract infection. Here's some antibiotics and come back and, you know, yeah. see me if it doesn't go away. I think that's a dangerous scenario. And I've seen, you know, I can think of one or two people in my head in the last 8 years that I've seen that were one lady in particular who was treated for a year with microscopic hematuria, and it was blamed on urinary tract infections. And when she had an actual evaluation, you know, not only did she have bladder cancer that was muscle invasive, but it was near her left ureteral orifice and it had obstructed her left kidney.
Gosh.
And she, you know, not only was going to lose her bladder, but lost a kidney because of that as well.
Right.
So,
yeah. And so, looking at gross hematuria for really any reason that can't be explained by a kidney stone, even if it's resolved, and then persistent blood in the urine microscopically should yeah. be really a referral.
Yeah, and again, the key is not just on a dipstick analysis, because we get people sent that
yeah.
have, you know, we get paperwork from their primary care doctor, and they have two dipstick analysis that show trace blood,
right.
and then you look at it on the microscope in the office, and it's completely
there.
Clear.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, and I don't understand why, you know, you look at it, and especially in women, if it's not a well-collected sample, we see a lot of epithelial cells looking under
right.
the microscope. And for whatever reason, those seem to trigger false positives on a dipstick analysis
yeah.
for microscopic hematuria quite frequently.
Right. If we can speak a little bit to the kidney stone issue, you know, because we've covered a lot of the folks either without symptoms or that we have an explanation for. But the folks that do come in with more classic pain, either flank pain or abdominal or pelvic pain, they have blood in the urine, we're suspicious of a kidney stone. Some discussion out there about appropriate diagnostics for that, whether we jump straight to a CT scan with the renal stone protocol versus ultrasound versus plain film versus just following symptomatically for a few days. Do you have thoughts on that or guidelines on that?
I mean, I'm always happy to see people, especially if someone has a history of kidney stones and they're having pretty classic symptoms. We have two x-ray machines to do KUBs in our office, and pretty much anybody that either has a history of stones or has a history that suggests that they may be passing a kidney stone, we're always going to start with a KUB on those individuals as well as a urinalysis.
It is a plain x-ray.
You know, not all stones will show up on a plain KUB,
yeah.
on a plain abdominal x-ray. So, you know, if someone's got microscopic hematuria, has classic flank pain radiating, you know,
yeah.
around with associated nausea, vomiting, you know, all the classic symptoms of renal colic, and they have microscopic hematuria, but we don't see anything on an x-ray, you know, 30 to 40% of stones are either in a location where they may be overlying the
sure.
pelvic bones, overlying the sacrum, and you can't see sort of white on white.
Yeah.
Or they've got a stone that just doesn't have any calcium in it, and those right. are going to be radiolucent and not show up on an x-ray. You know, those are the individuals that you're going to need to probably either ultrasound or do a CT scan if they have not had any CT imaging in the last, you know, 12 to 24 months or so.
And so you guys wouldn't necessarily jump to straight as CT scan renal stone CT as a first line diagnostic necessarily?
I mean, somebody that has not had a CT scan imaging in a long period of time, being, you know, probably at least 24 months or so, I think that's somebody that probably does need
probably
that.
Didn't.
We want to try to reserve CT scans for people that, you know, have classic symptoms, have the blood in the urine, and, you know, you can't see it on the x-ray.
Yeah.
We don't want to overexpose people to CT scan radiation,
yeah.
and CT
right.
scans in this day and age are so prevalent. You know, a lot of times we can, you know, ask people, have you had a scan done recently? And again, you know, there's, you know, a million CT scans in the PAC system,
right.
which is good, because then we can access that,
sure.
look down at the computer and see, you know, okay, this individual had a CT scan done 7 months ago. They've got these symptoms now. There were no stones on the CT scan back then. So probably it's likely something else, or maybe they have formed a very small stone that's going to be likely to pass, and you
yep.
can go with more conservative management at that time. or you got somebody that had a CT scan done 6 months, 12 months ago that clearly showed a stone in the right kidney, symptoms. And now they're having symptoms, so presumably right. It's fallen out of the kidney. So, you know, it's good that we've got that information, but we need to be careful for not overdoing it with CAT scans
of course.
Well.
Yeah. One last question on the kidney stone issue, and that is when a person fails to pass one. So now one of the questions that often comes up is how long do we wait? Let's say we've done an image or at some point during this process and we see there's clearly a stone there. And perhaps, I know in discussions in the past, one of the decision points is, does there appear to be hydronephrosis or not? Is there a clear blockage of the flow out from the kidney? You know, at what point do we continue to follow versus refer for ongoing kidney stones that don't pass?
I mean, I really think that any kidney stone that somebody is actually passing, and you've got evidence either with a CT scan or ultrasound that there's either hydronephrosis or a CT scan demonstrating a stone clearly in somebody's ureter, I think a urology referral is appropriate. And we see those patients all the time from the emergency room mm-hmm. as well, where, you know, somebody goes in, they've got a 2 millimeter kidney stone that they're passing, and it's in one of the ureters. You know, that individual is going to have probably a 95% to 98% chance of being able to pass that stone. I still think even in that situation that it's appropriate to follow up with them so that, you know, once they're over this episode, we can discuss preventative measures moving forward. We can take a family history and see, you know, the kidney stones very often run in families if they've got a strong family history and maybe, you know, they've never been seen by a urologist, but they passed 3 or 4 stones. You know, that's somebody that may require a metabolic evaluation. Mm-hmm. So I think putting the onus on us as urologists to make that determination, I think is definitely appropriate.
So. Okay. So thinking about the other topic we wanted to discuss was on urinary tract infections. One of the things that you had mentioned is getting a fair number of referrals for recurrent urinary tract infections for folks that maybe have never had a culture done, for instance, that sort of thing. But talking about some of the issues that you see in those referrals and how to help us kind of make those more efficient.
Yeah, I mean, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I think primary care providers probably have guidelines that they follow, mm-hmm. and I think the ER does too, as far as, you know, someone shows up with classic symptoms of dysuria, frequency, mm-hmm. urgency, and, right. you know, it's not necessary to get a culture, start them with, you know, Keflex or whatever first-line antibiotic treatment may be based on sure. what their allergy profile is.
Right.
You know, someone who's 50 year old female who has her first urinary tract infection and it gets appropriately treated and the symptoms go away, you know, is probably not somebody that we necessarily need to see. We see lots of people that do have recurrent urinary tract infections, and when we get that paperwork from the primary care provider, a lot of times, you know, the main thing that I need to see is lacking, and that's, you know, your documentation of urine cultures, because they're getting sent to me for a couple different reasons. You know, number one, is there a cause mm-hmm. or something that's causing this to happen that I can fix potentially as a urologic surgeon? Or number two, you know, what can we do to try to prevent this moving forward in the future? It's really the second reason that makes not having that information very difficult, because mm-hmm. if I want to put somebody on a prophylactic antibiotic, not having the information to know what bacteria they were getting infected with in the past is detrimental, and not knowing, you know, the resistance and susceptibility profiles for those bacteria makes it difficult for me to pick an antibiotic to put them on to take right. on a daily basis. That often can be very effective strategy for patients to take a prophylactic antibiotic for a period of time as far as decreasing the frequency of their infections, but picking the appropriate one becomes more difficult when we don't have access to any urine cultures that were done in the past.
Right. What are some of the surgical, and I'm saying that word broadly because there are other procedures besides true surgery that you guys do to deal with this problem, but what are some of those interventions that you often provide for patients that have documented recurrent UTI?
Yeah. I'll typically do 2 tests. I'll do something simple to look at the kidneys, and ultrasound evaluation is a simple, you know, no radiation exposure type mm-hmm. test to do. And the main thing we're looking for is to ensure that there's no obstruction, no hydronephrosis. We're also looking for kidney stones. You know, people that have recurrent infections are prone to having struvite stones or staghorn stones. So that's sort of a simple screening test to look for that. And then I do a cystoscopy and a pelvic exam as well on patients. So occasionally we'll see somebody that has hydronephrosis. I've, you know, seen women in their 50s and 60s where you diagnose vesicoureteral reflux on them and, you know, you need to do treatment for that. I just had a 46-year-old female in the office the other day who on her cystoscopy, she had a ureter seal that was undiagnosed, and that's a congenital issue. So, you know, we see women in their late teens, early 20s, where occasionally we'll see a ureter seal or other congenital abnormalities of the urinary tract that haven't been diagnosed to that point in time. Right. But, you know, it's something that is nice when you find it because it usually is a pretty quick and easy fix and takes care of the problem for them. Yeah.
How about, and I know after menopause, it becomes even more of an issue for lots of different reasons. Can you talk a little bit about that, some of the interventions you guys provide to help deal with those issues?
Yeah, I mean, part of the pelvic exam that we would do at a cystoscopy at that point in time is going to be assessing the vaginal tissues. You know, someone who's 70, 80, who's, you know, been postmenopausal for a long period of time, probably has some atrophic vaginitis and would benefit by estrogen cream, Premarin cream, you know, something like that. And and there is reasonable data that shows that that can change the local pH of the vagina and cause, you know, different types of bacteria that are less pathogenic to grow.
Right.
You know, other things that we recommend, there's some reasonable data on taking cranberry tablets, cranberry supplements, drinking cranberry juice as far as having antibiotic effects. I recommend probiotics a lot of times. You know, there's lots of different, more conservative measures that we can do besides just, you know, throwing somebody on a daily prophylactic antibiotic. For women that can relate the timing of their infections to sexual activity, which is not an infrequent occurrence, you know, we can limit the amount of prophylaxis that we give them. So that's a nice scenario to have.
Just timing it around.
And I typically tell people, you know, take one pill immediately after sexual activity, one pill 12 hours later, and then stop, versus somebody who, you know, you don't have that sort of temporal relationship. Right. And it's unfortunately, you know, you're going to need to take this on a daily basis.
Every day,
so,
sure.
Yeah.
I've seen interventions such as collagen, periurethral collagen for incontinence. This is maybe overlapping in some cases, but also a related condition. And then also pelvic floor surgery. Do you find that has either of those interventions have an effect on UTIs as well?
Treatment of stress incontinence, probably not so much.
Okay.
Treatment of pelvic organ prolapse, specifically a cystocele or a bladder prolapse. Uh-huh. Yes, I think that's something that it can easily prevent women from completely emptying their bladders.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have residual urine inside the bladder, you know, it's a perfect setup for having recurrent urinary tract infections. And by fixing the anatomy, you can improve the function. And a lot of times that issue will go away. So again, that's part of the overall evaluation that we do with a pelvic exam at the time of our cystoscopy. And this, you know, is in addition to looking at the quality of the vaginal tissues, we're assessing for prolapse as well.
Sure.
And I typically will check a post-void residual on almost everyone that comes in with recurrent urinary tract infections, again, to make sure that they're emptying their bladder out completely. Because, you know, that truly is our best defense against getting your recurrent infections is periodically throughout the daytime getting rid of every last drop of urine that's inside our bladder. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's something that's frequently seen in men as well who have enlarged prostates that it's impairing their bladder ability to empty. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time. I think just in this discussion, think about other topics down the road because there's a whole list of them. We talk about incontinence being one. That's a huge problem we see in primary care. And I think we had discussed earlier things like testicular pain, common primary care complaint, and then sort of the big one, prostate cancer. I look forward to maybe having other conversations with you and your peers to try to help navigate those waters a little bit.
Yeah, sounds great.
Appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.